And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper here, along with colleague Bonnie Berman. In the words of famed attorney Clarence Darrow, quote, "I never wanted to see anybody die, but there are a few obituary notices I've read with pleasure." Joining me now is Miami Herald staff writer Eleanor Brecker. Her chief assignment for the paper and its website are obituaries. Welcome to you, Ellie Brecker. Good to see you again.
Hi, good to see you.
Getting the right balance between solemnity and history, is the obit sort of an art form?
Good question. Yes, it is. You have to be exquisitely sensitive to both what your job is as a chronicler of history and the people you're dealing with who are grieving, and the sometimes difficult histories of the people you're writing about.
Tell us about that, the difficulty speaking with the relatives and the friends and the family members.
It often depends on the circumstances of the death, what sort of state of mind the survivors are going to be in. For instance, a man or a woman dies at age 90. They've been on the slow decline of old age. The adult children know this is going to happen. That's one scenario. There are sudden events, and I did one recently, which involved a wonderful man in the prime of his life who just had a sudden event, and that was the end of it. And his family was understandably shell shocked.
Right.
As with all reporting, you have to listen. And you can pick up clues from the way somebody presents themselves to you that will guide you through the process.
How is it decided what regional figures are going to be, have a full article editorial? Is that your choice or to your editors or a combination?
Don't worry, Joe, I'll write about you.
Well, I hope not too soon.
It's a combination. There are some folks who there's no question about it. For instance, this morning on the front page we had Tony Goldman.
Right.
The developer who revolutionized South Beach and Wynwood. Not a surprise to his loved ones, but a surprise to the public.
And he was fairly young, wasn't he?
So from where I sit, yeah,
yes.
He was 68. And we had to scramble on that, but fortunately there was so much about him available to us, both in our own clip file and, national press and through his company. The thing that makes an obit come alive, as it were, is the material you get from the people who were the nearest and dearest of the deceased. And let me tell you something, there's nothing sadder to me than talking to adult children who don't know anything about their parents. And while they're talking to me, they realize it's now too late and they'll never know.
That's pretty common, isn't it?
Unfortunately so.
Tell us, when we were talking before the show began, you were telling me about your dad and what you did with your dad. That's incredible, when he was sick and getting dialysis.
Well, I became committed to this notion when I was working on my book in 1994 about Schindler's List survivors, Schindler's Legacy, True Stories of the List Survivors. Many of the survivors I spoke to said, my children have been, pushing me to tell them my history. I can't do it, but you're a stranger. I'll tell you. It'll be easier. And I became so committed to the notion that everybody's life story deserves to be preserved. And I did that with my own parents. Whenever I was with them, I would just stick a tape recorder in front of them or, you know, start taking notes. My dad spent the last 8 years of his life on dialysis. He was in his 90s, and I would just go and sit with him and spend that time hearing the stories, recording the stories.
So making those recordings, was that sort of a forerunner of this business, which I'd like you to talk about, the pre-bits?
The pre-bits. The pre-bits started out to be a very noble endeavor. Unfortunately, the reality of time and staffing of video crews at the Herald kind of got in the way of it. The idea of the pre-bit was to interview certain people we knew would be major obits before their death, mm-hmm. and to do a little 3-minute video to go along with it. And one of the first ones we did was your dear old colleague Audrey Finkelstein.
Oh my gosh.
And she was, as you can imagine, a wealth of recollections and information, and she had all the memorabilia, and she was a great talker, and it was lovely.
In the old days, I know that local newspapers, people who were prominent figures, the staff kept an update so that when they went, they would just have to kind of tack on a paragraph at the end of how it finally happened. Is that still maintained?
Well, that was the good old days when we had a lot more people in the newsroom than we do now. We have a small collection of in-the-can obits for certain prominent people. And then what will sometimes happen is, you know, we'll hear so-and-so's in the hospital. You know, so-and-so's in hospice. You better get ready. And we'll scramble around and do that. But, you know, very often it's a matter of doing it on deadline. And the gift of the internet, of course, makes some of that a lot easier. You know, you have research at your fingertips. But very often I'm back plowing around in the stacks of those dusty old clips in the paper envelopes that disintegrate in your hand.
Called the morgue.
Yes, right, the morgue. There's so much history back there. It's just amazing.
I'd like to go back to the 60s.
Me too. When do we leave?
Let's go. Do you still consider yourself a hippie?
Absolutely.
All right.
Reconstructed.
I was interested in your activism in the 60s, that you dropped out of the University of Wisconsin to join SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society. Why did you drop out?
I got to Madison, Wisconsin in the fall of 66, and pretty much on day one discovered the very vibrant anti-war movement. It was one of the cradles of the anti-war movement, and I believed so strongly in that staying in college seemed like a waste of time. Were my parents thrilled about that decision? Oh, my God, you can
no.
just imagine. But I devoted myself, you know, body and soul to the anti-war movement for several years and then had the bizarre interlude of trying to organize the campus of the University of Oklahoma in Norman.
And they were not organized, I take it.
They just weren't really into that, but we tried.
And then you also moved on to the University of Arizona, where you were an outstanding journalism student there starting in 1977, and you went on to a really fine paper, the Louisville Courier-Journal.
Yes. Yes, yes. I was so lucky because I had a really unconventional path into journalism. I was just almost 29 when I finally got a BA in Tucson, and it had been only two years since I discovered my career path. You know, being a waitress in a Mexican restaurant just got a little old after a while, and I went back to school and took an English course, and some professor said, you know, you write pretty well, so why don't you go over there to the journalism department? And I did, and, you know, the rest is my modestly successful history.
We were speaking with the Miami Herald's Ellie Brecker, Eleanor Brecker. And our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, that's easy enough, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. Eleanor, a couple of years ago, I had Edna Buchanan on the program. I'm sure she's a good friend of yours. And she said she always loved to write obituaries, and she was very good at it because she loved to have the response from family and members who were touched by it and would remember it all their lives.
Well, that can go both ways, and I'm still surprised by the reaction. On the positive side, recently I did an obit that ran on the front of the local section about a terrific guy named Al Jaffe, who was a World War II flying ace, and his family could not have been more grateful and lovely and just effusive. And then it's funny you mention that, because I brought some printouts of old obits that I did. Sometimes you think that, you know, you're going to get a big attagirl from someone, and there's one thing in there that some member of the family didn't like, and suddenly, you know, you're the worst person in the world. But what are you going to do? You know, you kind of have to tell the truth about people. I brought in the first obit I did for the Herald as an obit writer was Pat Tornillo.
Oh, my.
You know, what are you going to say in the lead for that person? Of course, his family loved him. But for listeners who don't know, he was the disgraced and fallen and once very powerful head of the teachers union in Dade County. So it's, you know, what is Bill Clinton's obit lead going to read?
What's the process that you to begin an obituary? Of course, gathering material, but is there sort of a theme and variations that goes on? Or?
Well, the first question that I have to answer, and I get pitched a lot by families, is, did this person make a mark in this community? And you don't have to be a Pat Tornillo. You don't have to be a Tony Goldman. I've written about cops and firefighters and paramedics and Girl Scout leaders and teachers and all kinds of folks. But you have to have made some kind of an impact outside your immediate corner of the world.
Can we go back to the Courier Journal?
We can.
In Louisville, Kentucky?
Louisville,
that's
right. I told her that the other day. It's Louisville.
Sorry about that. Louisville. It's hard to say. You received an award in 1986 from the American Cancer Society for outstanding coverage of cancer. You yourself, I understand, are a survivor of breast cancer.
That's true. In 1986, I wrote a cover story for the Sunday magazine of that paper about my own experience with breast cancer. Now, remember, nice ladies were not writing about their boobs back then. Now it seems like everybody who's ever had breast cancer has a book out, but back then it was sort of a radical thing to do. But I had been diagnosed on my baseline mammogram at age 36 the year before. And I had a terrible family history. I knew that it wasn't a question of would I ever have breast cancer. It was when would I have breast cancer. I didn't think it would be at age 36. But it was, you know, it of course dominated my life for several years. And then I just got to a point at which I thought, okay, been there, done that. Let's just move on and have the rest of my life and not think about this anymore.
And how are you now?
Thank God, I'm fine. Well, one of the decisions I made, I think I was 41, was to have the unaffected breast removed as a preventive measure, because 2 years after I was diagnosed, my mom was diagnosed, and the following year my sister was diagnosed. And at that point I thought, it's just not worth it to live with this kind of anxiety. And to be 41 and single and have no breasts, was that a difficult decision on some level? Of course. But here I am, you know, and I'm fine.
Let's turn to animals. I notice on Facebook that there are frequent posts from you.
From
you're trying to
animals.
Place at-risk or abandoned animals. That's quite a passion for you.
It's a passion, and it's given me a full house. And
the wild kingdom?
Exactly, wild living room. But this community is not good to its animals. This is not a good place to be a stray dog. And there are a lot of factors that go into that. Some of them are economic. Some of them are cultural. But the condition of animal care, despite the very best efforts of some very dedicated people at Miami-Dade Animal Services, is dire. We're going to have a chance to fix that.
Tell us about that. That's the Pets Trust.
Come Election Day, you're going to be asked to vote on a teeny weeny property tax increase that would generate a discrete revenue stream every year for the care of animals outside of the county system. The money does not go to animal services. It would create free, low-cost spay-neuter clinics around the county in places where people don't have access to that service. It would provide mobile units to go into communities, education programs. 34,000-ish dogs and cats enter the shelter every year. Here's the most staggering figure out of that. 90% of adult cats die there, euthanized, because there's no home for them. The numbers on dogs are getting much better. They're up to in the, you know, 50, 60, 70% placement range, depending on the season, etc. But that's still a lot of animals, healthy, viable, adoptable animals that die in that shelter because there's no place for them. And frankly, as long as people go to breeders and to puppy mills and to pet shops and pay hundreds, sometimes thousands of dollars for animals that are sitting there in the animal shelter that you could have for, you know, $65, $75, they come to you spayed, neutered, microchipped, etc. It just, you know, it never ceases to amaze me that people won't go save a life. They'd rather, you know, write $1,200 checks to a puppy mill for a miniature beagle.
How can we change that culture? What do you think?
Well, that's what one of the missions of the Pets Trust is to do public education, get into the schools, talk to kids about it, educate youngsters who can then go home and take that message to their parents about what it means to be a responsible pet owner.
Every 6 months or so, it seems that we have this horse slaughter business going on in the Western perimeter. I think about 3 weeks ago, it struck again. I'm sure it's very difficult to try to patrol and enforce this business. Why are these people why are they going after these horses? For the meat, I suppose.
They go after it for the meat. It's free to them, and they can sell it. And culturally, there are certain cultures that prize horse meat. You can't legally buy it anywhere in Dade County. It's not legal. You can't go to the butcher and say, you know, I'd like a pound of thoroughbred, please. But you can go into somebody's paddock, somebody's corral in the middle of the night. And I don't want to get too graphic, but most of these animals are not dead when the butchery begins.
Let's take a telephone call. We're speaking with the Miami Herald's Eleanor Brecker. First caller, this is Linnea. Is that correct? In Miami, hi.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, thank you. First of all, Ellen, I want to thank you so much for writing many beautiful obituaries.
Thank you.
And secondly, I want to ask you what purpose you feel that the written obituaries serve in the life of the community, and then finally, if you've given any thought to your own obituary and who you would like to do that and how you would like to be portrayed in your own obituary.
Well, I'm going to answer that in reverse order because I expect to take the example of my late, very great colleague, the legendary journalist Gene Miller, who wrote his own. And he wrote his own because he didn't trust anybody else to write it. I will probably do that, warts and all. It's interesting because I am increasingly getting inquiries from people who would like me to interview them in life so that they can be remembered in their own words.
Control things from the grave.
Yeah, exactly. Obituaries are, they're just posthumous biographies. And what I try to do with them is put these people in the context of the world in which they lived. And that's why I love the folks who, you know, grew up in Miami before it was what it is today. And describing their lives also gives you background about the community we all live in. There's people great and small who have helped make this community what it is, for better or for worse, and they all contribute something to the fabric of the life we live.
Getting back to your early life, I was interested to find out about your family's. Tell us about your family's relationship to the famed Apollo Theater in Harlem.
Yeah, my family's relationship to the famed Apollo Theater in Harlem was that my grandfather, the late Leo Brecker, and a friend of his, Frank Schiffman, bought the theater in the 1920s. And it became a showcase for African-American talent, legendary African-American talent. There have been books written about it, clearly, but, you know, if you were a black artist, you didn't arrive.
And you better be good.
You better be good.
Oh, yeah.
Toughest audience on the planet.
Isn't it still? I mean, that's...
Well, it has changed in... It's now, you know, owned by a nonprofit foundation, et cetera. There's still performances there. But in the good old days of, you know, amateur night where they'd yank you off the stage with a hook, I don't think there's anything like that anymore.
Tell me, Ellie Brecker, any advice for young journalists in today's media landscape? You've seen quite a shift in the way the news is covered.
Well, the cynical part of me says, yes, my advice is go to law school. But I know that... go get an MBA. Thank God for young kids who still have the passion to do this. And we've got some amazing youngsters at the Herald who are fully committed to being as tough as a Gene Miller ever was. One of the main differences, of course, is technology. You know, if you can't file a 20-inch story on your smartphone from, you know, under a car in the middle of a shootout in the Pork and Beans Project, you're at a liability. Frankly, at this stage of what's required technically, I'm really glad I'm old.
I just wanted to bring up the Schindler's Legacy, True Stories of the List Survivors. Why did you write that book? Was it, after seeing the movie or after reading the book?
It started in the movie theater itself. I went to see the movie at the theater at 163rd Street. And there are a lot of survivors who live around there, and the theater was full of survivors. And It was sort of a madhouse in the theater because people were seeing things that were part of their life, and they were crying, and they were running out, and they were coming back in. And I thought, what is going on here? So, you know, of course, I realized that there were a lot of survivors in South Florida, and I wrote a story about eight of them, and it became a book.
Well, it's been a great pleasure this half hour. We've been speaking with Miami Herald staff writer Eleanor Brecker. It's always good to see you, and the best to you.
Thank you.
Food and Dining up next.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. We're funded by listeners like you and by Indomina, presenting The Imposter, a documentary about a mysterious reappearance of a long-missing Texas teenager found in Spain, opening Friday at a theater near you. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino presents Anderson Cooper on September 20th. Cooper, host of CNN's Anderson Cooper 360, will be live and on stage at Hard Rock Live. Tickets at Ticketmaster.com and MyHRL.com.
We'd like to thank our corporate underwriters, Kids in Distress, the law firm of Parrots, Chesil & Herman, and Saglo Development Corporation. These corporate underwriters help bring you the programs you enjoy throughout the year. Please join WLRN in thanking them for their continued support. We're funded by listeners like you and by the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. IFAS enriches the lives of students, communities, and all Floridians by providing academic and everyday solutions to problems concerning food, the environment, and economic development. IFAS features the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, research and education centers, and UF Extension with programs in every Florida county. U of F IFAS is on the web at ifas.ufl.edu.
And we return. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper here, along with colleague Bonnie Berman. Thursday has finally arrived. The Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, begins Sunday. So we're joined by chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer, as well as a chef from Miami Beach's legendary Epicure Markets and Cafes. And what a spread of delights here in the studio. They really outdid themselves.
We are lucky today, aren't we? Wow. Well, you know, it's the holiday and the entertaining season here. Starting Sunday night, the Jews across the world will celebrate Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. And it's a happy holiday, and as with most all holidays, food and family play an important role. So, and in addition to that, the kids are back in school. It's time for having friends over. It's party time. So our guest today is here to help us plan our festive meals. And as you mentioned, he's Epicure Markets Executive Chef Hector Morales. Welcome, Chef Morales.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
It's great. Oh, it's our pleasure, believe me.
Thank you.
Very definitely. And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any festive meal questions for our expert? Give us a call with your questions, or maybe you have some suggestions. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
And email, that's radio at WLRN.org.
Also with us, our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. You can read Fred's column in today's Miami Herald, and he's joining us by Skype. Fred, are we drinking today? Do I need to ask?
You don't need to ask. We're going to talk about kosher wine, obviously.
All right. Great. Well, Chef Morales, Sunday, Jewish New Year. What foods are special for the year, and why for the New Year?
Well, first thing, you have to have sweets on the table. And along with those sweets, we have the honey cakes, and we have our simis, we have our nuts and fruits, and of course, you got to have brisket. Brisket or turkey or roast caponette or our oven roaster, nice and juicy when you cut into it. It has to be perfectly cooked, and
that's what we do. How did you get this brisket so tender?
Well, it's you have to cook it at the right temperature to begin with, 400 degrees.
At 400?
400 degrees, because you want to be able to cook, you cover it up with aluminum foil with a nice mirepoix of vegetables, celery, carrots, onions, tomatoes, bay leaves, fresh garlic, paprika, salt and pepper. That's all it takes. And you rub it in real good, and you sear it nice and tight, and you put it in the oven. And bingo, before you have it, 3 hours are gone, it's fork tender. You got to use a fork. All ovens are different. Some ovens cook faster, some slower. So make sure you use a fork, and when you touch your brisket, if it comes out nice and clean, it's ready to come out of the oven.
How about that, Fred?
Sounds good to me. I'm ready.
Well, Fred, we have been enjoying this for sure. But here's my question to you. What I find, how do you cook it so that it's not, it doesn't feel dry or stringy, especially when you go to carve into it? It's, you know, to slice it so it's not so stringy. And guess what? I've been there and done that. So what should I do?
Well, the main thing is when you cut it against the bias, meaning when the strings come to your right, you're going to cut to your left against it, where it comes out nice, long, and smooth. If you cut with the bias, you're going to get long strings of brisket. It's going to be tough. So for the tenderness, you have to cut against the bias. That's
but
all
how,
it means.
How do you keep it from falling apart when you're cutting it?
Like I say, fork tender. You don't want to overcook it, the brisket. So while you're cooking it for 3 hours, check it. Some ovens are different. Check it at 2.5 hours and see if the fork comes out nice.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, you got to let it sit on the table for a little while, maybe 15 minutes before you even cut into it, because when it's hot, it's still steaming. So let it sit, and then you slice it. It will not be overcooked. It'll be juicy. And I like my second cut, which is the fatty part. And because the juiciness and the flavor just comes out of the brisket.
And when you served it to me, you said, here's the fatty part, and here's the other part.
The first cut and the second cut, of course.
Right. And you know, the wonderful thing about brisket is it's not just for a holiday. Any time you're having people over, it tastes better if you make it the day before.
I love it. It's all year round. We cook it all year round, uh-huh. to be honest with you. And customers all year round put in special orders for it. And a lot of times they order 5 pounds, 7 pounds. They have a big family over. So they order a whole brisket, you know, and they want to cut in sections. We separate the two parts. And the majority of them for special orders, they always ask for the fatty part, the second cut. So we actually sell a little more of the
I
second cut.
I want everybody to know that every time he says the fatty part, he has a big smile on his face.
I love it.
Obviously.
What is the biggest brisket you've been asked to make?
Well, they usually run 9 ups. 9 pounds and over. But I have some that weigh about 14, 15 pounds. They're really, really nice for a family of 15, 18 people. You know?
That would make a great sandwich, wouldn't it?
Oh, God, I love
18
it.
18-pound sandwich, Fred?
Yeah. With some coleslaw on top, of course.
Well, that's certainly wonderful. But the table is absolutely filled with other foods. Another food, as you mentioned, it's for a sweet New Year, so a lot of sweet foods are there. And one that I think maybe many people don't know about is called simis. Tell us about that.
Well, simis, you first have to use fresh sweet potatoes. It can be canned if you want a good flavor. Carrots, prunes, honey, lemon juice has to be fresh when you put into it. And, of course, a little pinch of cinnamon, a little pinch of nutmeg. And when you mix all those up together, the honey just adds so much flavor to it. And I like it warm. I don't like it real hot. When you warm it up in the oven and you eat it, you just can't stop. You want to keep eating and eating and eating it. You know, it's simply delicious.
And this one has pineapple in it.
Oh, you definitely. Yeah. That's the top secret to it. At the end, always put a little crushed pineapple in it. When you stir it up, it adds a different dimension of flavor to it.
Is that fresh pineapple?
No, it's jam.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, not fresh.
Pineapple jam? Or do you mean canned?
Filling. No, it's a filling.
Pineapple filling, pineapple for a pie filling.
Right, exactly. Like you don't use too much, just
now
a little
bit
of flavor.
Now we're getting your real secrets, aren't we?
I didn't want to give it to you, but you got it.
Well, what about these recipes? Can we get these recipes?
Yes, you can. If you contact us at www.rpcurie.com, we usually on a website, we put it up, and we have a lot of recipes there already. But if you specify you want one and we were able to do it, we'd be more than happy to do so.
Epicure.com.
Yes.
So if if you wanted to last minute, as many of us are so busy during the week and all, and Sunday night they have to make a dinner, can they just come into the store and pick up food?
We have a lot of the items available when you walk into the store. We have the potato kugel, we have the simis, we have the noodle pudding, which is fantastic. We have a lot of our soup, the matzo balls, the gefilte fish, the mini balls, the crepla, chicken noodle soup. I mean, we have a large variety of soup that you just come in and pick it up. If you're feeding a family of over 10, of course, you call in and put a special order in, and we'll be glad to please your liking, whatever you like.
Now, you've been at Epicure for what, 40 years?
Over 40 years.
Over 40 years.
Yes.
My goodness. And that store is 60 years old. So.
Yes, yes, yes.
So you've been making the prepared food there. Epicure's famous for its prepared foods. Do you make all of that on premise?
Yes, we do. Nothing comes out of state. We do it right on premises. Every single day is made fresh.
What about those potatoes? What are they called?
Oh, my God. These tricolor marble potatoes. They're small, and they look like marbles. That's what they call them, marbles.
They are heavenly.
But
yes,
when you put a little olive oil and fresh herbs and salt and pepper on them, and you put them at high heat, high heat 400 degrees in the oven, that tends to sear them. It only takes about 20 minutes to cook. But when you pull them out of the oven, you can smell the aroma of the herbs and the flavor. Oh, my gosh. They're fantastic.
Yes, they are
delicious. So what's so interesting about these is they're little tiny ones, and you have that Yukon Gold and the purple ones. And
Peruvian purple potatoes, Yukon Gold, red bliss potato, and our white potatoes.
All together
in a medley.
Could you make that in advance and rewarm it? How would that be?
Very simple. That's what we do. For special orders, a lot of customers order 5 pounds, 6 pounds, 7 pounds.
Uh-huh.
We cook it ahead of time and put them in aluminum pans for the customer to pick up with a lid with heating instructions on top.
So then it could keep overnight in the refrigerator?
Definitely.
And
not in the car, in the refrigerator.
Right. That's another point. If you're going to pick up foods, specialty foods already prepared, don't stop at the soccer game.
Definitely not.
Don't do your errands. Get home and put it in the refrigerator.
Straight in the refrigerator.
Right. Now, that's another point you mentioned, heating instructions. Reheating prepared foods can be really, really tricky. So what are some tips here?
Well, the FDA already specified for us, we're under HACCP.
Well, explain what HACCP is. I don't think a lot of people know.
HACCP is the guidelines that the government has for you to handle foods in your establishments. And you have to go strictly by their guidelines. And we have a specialist on board with us, Oscar. He takes care of all of that.
So it's healthy guidelines.
Definitely.
Sanitary guidelines. And so then what's the general rule for heating things up?
Okay, when you're reheating, you have to make sure you bring it up to 165 degrees.
The food,
definitely.
How do you do that without drying it out and making it horrible?
That's why you have to cover them up and make sure your oven temperature is not so high. No, 325 to 350, no higher than that.
And sometimes I tell people, is it ready? Well, put your finger on it. It's already been cooked. It needs to be warm. When it's warm, it's ready, correct?
Right, but you have to have the right temperature.
Okay.
I guess you never use a microwave, right?
I personally don't.
Okay.
But a lot of people do.
He had a very definite don't on
that. I heard that.
Yes, did you hear that?
Yes.
And it's party season's coming up. It's in full swing. And I understand you give classes in the art of entertaining.
Yes, we do.
What are some general tips? We only have a minute, but go ahead. What's some general tips?
Okay, the general tip is we set up menus and recipes, and we talk about the recipe. We cook on premises what the recipes are, and we have a tasting that people come up and taste everything that we make, and we make it entertaining, where they could be part of the show, as a part of the class that we give. And not only that, once they taste the food, they, wow, give me that recipe. And we do have the recipes available that day. So before they go
home,
you show
them how to cook it and how to serve it.
Definitely.
That's part of the entertaining.
Definitely.
And I understand you have a contest for all, it's called an all-access class pass. So if you go to their Facebook, which is epicuremarket.com, you might win that.
Definitely.
Is it epicure.com or epicuremarket.com?
Epicuremarket.com.
Oh, sorry, okay. epicuremarket.com.
Right. All right. Do you have opening on your staff for a staff taster?
If you bring
a lot of money.
As long as you bring the wine.
Okay, I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guest is Epicure Executive Chef Hector Morales. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. We're funded by listeners like you and by Athena Health, offering physicians a dinner seminar on meaningful use and profitability. That's Thursday, September 13th at the Boca Raton Resort and Club. Details at athenahealth.com/Miami. South Florida Theater League and 91.3 WLRN offer same-day half-price tickets at leading regional theaters and cultural organizations, including Broward Stage Door Theater, the Plaza Theater, Empire Stage, and the Alliance Theater Lab. Information and a complete list of shows online at culturalconnection.org. Culturalconnection.org, your ticket to the cultural arts.
We're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Epicure Executive Chef Hector Morales is with us. He's been giving us tips on food for the Jewish holidays and also the art of entertaining, and we have been really enjoying this food. Fabulous. And I understand that they're going to be opening an Epicure Market in Coral Gables in the summer of 2013. And a restaurant in the store, right, Chef?
Definitely, definitely. That's after November.
After November in the Miami Beach store.
It's going to be a full-service restaurant. With waitresses and the whole nine yards. And
wow.
The food's going to be very, very tasty and outstanding.
Okay. Well, for those nights when you're actually going to make dinner at home, it's dinner in minutes time. And we've already mentioned that honey plays an important role in the holidays. It's sweet holidays. So here's a quick and easy almond chicken with orange honey sauce. And what to go with it is garlic zucchini strips with grape tomatoes. I use chicken cutlets because you can buy them already cut that way. They're about a half inch thick, and they only take 4 to 5 minutes to cook. And then I dip the chicken in some seasoned flour and a few hot pepper flakes. Sauté it just 2 minutes aside, and I remove the chicken from the skillet, and I add some orange juice and honey. Chef is looking, shaking his head, yes, okay. And cook the sauce down a little bit, and then to thicken the sauce, just a teaspoon of cornstarch and a little bit and about a tablespoon of the orange juice. Cook it all together. It takes only a few minutes to make. Put the sauce over the chicken, and I sprinkled some slivered almonds on top. Now, the side dish is really, really easy because I made it in the microwave. Sorry, Chef. I made mine in the microwave. And it can be made on the stovetop. You can steam them on the stovetop. But I cut the zucchini in little strips about 2 inches long, a quarter inch thick, a little garlic, and microwave that for just a couple of minutes. Toss it with some grape tomato, salt and pepper, and olive oil. Very simple, very colorful. And you ate that as well,
indeed.
Chef Food.
Boy. I'm doing very well today.
You had a big day today, and poor Fred.
And poor Fred.
Poor
I was
Fred.
Just thinking that.
And their dessert after.
But Joe, I guess no sausage today.
No, I don't think so.
All right, don't make him feel bad. Anyway, that recipe is in today's Miami Herald. And then there's another very sweet dish on my website. It's a roasted maple salmon with sweet potatoes and broccoli. Go to dinnerinminutes.com to see those recipes. And please, follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred, okay, what are we drinking?
Well, you know, when a friend of mine converted to Judaism a few years ago, the rabbi asked him a very interesting question. He said, "Are you sure you want to go to the trouble?" And you can see what he meant when you look at the trouble they go to over kosher wine. There's one form of kosher wine that's called mevushal, which is M-E-V-U-S-H-A-L. This is wine that remains kosher even if it's served by non-Jewish waiters, which might happen in a dinner or a wedding in a big hotel or something served by a caterer or something like that.
That's right. This is for people really, really observant.
That's
yes.
right.
Yes.
That's right. This goes back to Old Testament times when Jewish religious leaders sought to discourage Jews from drinking wine with pagan idolaters who worshiped Zeus or Bacchus or somebody like that. And they decreed that Jews could drink wine with idolaters only if it was boiled first. And the Hebrew word for boiled is mevushal. Of course, you don't do wine a lot of good by boiling it. So it was probably really done to discourage the practice altogether. But in recent years, as kosher wines have gotten a lot better in quality, they've come up with a less damaging way to make them mevushal. The Royal Wine Corporation in the U.S., with the approval of the Orthodox Union, has come up with a way to flash heat the wine, bringing it up to only about 180 degrees instead of 210, At 180 degrees, the first tiny bubbles form, so they're able to define that as having been boiled, and then they quickly re-chill it to preserve the quality. And the big machine they do use to do this is jokingly called a mavushulator. And if you want to buy wine that's mavushul, you just look at the back label or even the front label for an M inside a circle. So meanwhile, happy Rosh Hashanah.
So Fred, what does that do to the wine, heating it to 180 degrees even?
Well, that's a matter of disagreement. If you put a wine that has had that done to it beside one that hasn't, I think the best tasters in the crowd could probably tell the difference. But because, as I say, if you boil wine, you just take the fruit right out of it. So you have to, if you're a really good wine taster, you have to taste it and see if that's something that you want to put up with or whether you want to make sure you have Jewish servers.
Okay. We have a phone call. Michael in Miami, thanks for your patience. Did you have a question?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
My question is basically about teas, like all the dishes that he's described so far. I'm wondering what would be a great tea to pair them with, and I'd like to, if possible, recommend Indian black teas like Assam or Darjeeling blends specifically.
Chef is shaking his head. So yes. What kind of tea do you
We want? Have them all. We have a large variety of Indian teas, English teas, teas from all over the world, as a matter of fact. If you just come into a store today and browse around, you're going to be happy with what you find.
Great. Okay, thank you, Chef.
You're welcome.
Okay, and you're saying, Chef, that people want to have tea after the dinner.
Definitely.
Right. So different kinds of teas would be a fun thing to have. Yes.
Yes, for sure.
Okay, so Chef, we were talking about the art of entertaining just before the break. I understand you have also a flower arranging class for the entertaining.
Yes, our flower department is exclusive. They do so many beautiful flowers from all over the world, the large variety. And they give you a class there. You come in, enjoy it, and they'll take some flowers home with you.
Well, I have to, because this is on television, I'm sorry it isn't, because they brought the flower arrangement here. Which
Indeed
is
they did. I think that's the first.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's absolutely beautiful. And what I, to tell people what they've done is that it's all white and green. And it's white hydrangeas and white lilies, I think is what is on
yes.
there. And then the green foliage that goes with it. But what's interesting is they stuck green apples in it.
Granny Smith.
Yes.
And it's really a wonderful idea to have for the new year. Do you have any other tips for people about entertaining, what they should do?
Yes, we have a large catering department, which indoor, in-store and out-store. Karen Call has a marvelous job of this. And if you're planning on doing a party with any theme whatsoever, we're there to accommodate you in anything you like.
Okay. And you have, so as we mentioned, that you do have the classes on it. And do you have, like, other tips? Like, for example, I love the fact that the recipes you brought today could be made ahead of time. And that's really a great tip for people, that they can make things and then rewarm them. Another tip I like to give people is don't have every single course at the table all hot. I mean, if you're going to have a first course, then don't have it hot. Have it cold, maybe sitting on the table. It makes life much easier for you.
Yes, definitely. Of course it does.
Right.
And one of the things we like to do is try to satisfy our customers by making everything fresh on premises, like I said before. And if there's something, a lot of times I walk through the store and the customers will grab me and says, Hector, I had this last week. When are you going to make it again? I'm excited. I want to try it. So I'll tell them, next week, if you come in on Thursday, I have it on the line for you. And they get all excited and happy, and that's how we create good customers' relations.
So if you wanted something special, you could call in and ask for it to
definitely,
be made.
Definitely.
Right. Okay. Well, it's just been a wonderful, tasty week. Chef Hector Morales, thank you so much for joining us.
I hope some of that brisket's still left.
Well, I notice outside the studio here there's a lot of people.
A lot of activity.
The jackals are here.
Right, people I didn't know.
Let me give you my mailing address.
Well, thank you so much for
it's
the
been a
delicious
pleasure, really.
Food. You can find Chef's Prepared Foods at Epicure Market on Miami Beach, and they also have a market at Sunny Isles Beach. Joseph Cooper, you really ate well today.
Indeed.
Yes. Fred Tasker, great advice as always, Fred.
Always a pleasure.
We have everybody here saying they're missing you.
Well, I'm missing you guys.
Oh, well, you'll have to come down and visit us.
And your food. But in that order.
Oh, thank you. Well, next week is going to be a very popular one-hour restaurant review program with Jen Koretnik and Rochelle Koff and Jan Morris. So join us next week.
And I'm going to say goodbye to Bonnie, too.
Okay.
Oh, and goodbye to Bonnie,
okay.
too.
Bye-bye.
I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me.
And that wraps up today's edition. It was produced by Richard Ive, technical supervision by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary gives production assistance. We have free audio archives and MP3 downloads of past programs at our website, WLRN.org. Also, author and book links and more at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at this time, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat, another one of our patented live studio concerts. This one, a classical string quartet. Monday, we return with an ethical discussion about deciding to have or not to have children with philosophy professor Christine Overall. To the calendar. On this day in 1899, 113 years ago, Henry Hale Bliss dies in New York City from injuries suffered in the first recorded auto accident in America. He was run over by an electric car at 74th Street and Central Park West. And on this day, 1938, 74 years ago, the birth of Miss Manners, Judith Martin. She's written her advice column for more than 30 years. Yes, gentle reader, boors should not be tolerated. One more, while our troubles seem so far away, on this day, 1965, 47 years ago, the Beatles released the string quartet song Yesterday. It's the most covered song in history, with more than 3,000 versions. The melody came to Paul McCartney in a dream. We leave with a thought from Miss Manners, a Wellesley graduate whose father was a United Nations economist. Quote, "Chaperones don't enforce morality. They force immorality to be discreet." This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
You're listening to 9.